penetrating and perfect truth is seldom met with, even in 100,000 myriad kalpas. Now we can see and hear it. We can remember and accept it. I vow to make the Buddha's truth one with myself. Homage to the Buddha, homage to the Dharma, homage to the Sangha. So the subject of this talk is modifying karma. And I wanted to say deconstructing, because that would sound intellectual, or healing or cleansing, but you can't ever bet on it, but you can, I know you can modify it. So you can start there. And the what we use in Buddhism is a treasury of instruments for healing that include, I should first say that when I hear treasury of skill of dharma or whatever, I see a treasure chest, just like kind of like a cartoon with gleaming jewels inside when you open it up, and that's sort of true. But it's also true that it's like a doctor's bag, and it has tools in it that really do best if you make use of them for the appropriate use. So the general tools that are there for our tradition, and some of them we share with other traditions, but the first one is a first characteristic of this tradition of serene reflection is our essential mind is intrinsically luminous and pure. Or another way of saying is that all beings are essentially Buddha. The second one is pure meditation. The third one is precepts. And the fourth is gratitude. Now, sometimes you get a glimpse of the essential mind, and there's really not much you can say about it that will make that happen faster. So then there's pure meditation, which is a wonderful, uncomplicated gateway to the natural gateway to the truth. And then there's the precepts, which are, in other traditions, they are helpers specifically related to karma. In other traditions, like in Christianity, I remember it was do unto others as you would have them do unto you. And the precepts are like specifics of that very same truth. And so that we share tools with other traditions as well. And in addition, I think you could say that they involve karma as in as ye sow, so shall ye reap. And it's the old-fashioned language, and I actually think that has more room for me than treat others like you would have them treat you, or you know, you get your just desserts. But I always heard that as I was growing up, so it's what comes to mind for me. And the last one being gratitude, it's on a continuum with respect and bowing, which is essential to Buddhism and also to healing. And I have four stories four illustrations. They're sort of short anecdotes. And I'd just like to explain something first about these notes. So they're making noise. I made this so that it wouldn't make noise. And what I do is, as I have the thoughts, I put them on little index cards, and then I group them so that I will make sense, because I'm not a very sense-making person. And then I spread them out on the page and turn the page very calmly. But I had to leave the temple yesterday, so now I have some piles. But it should still work. So the first one is, and I'll give the four without really much explanation then I'll talk about them more. And it comes from the Lotus Sutra, and I find the old Buddhist scriptures very, very slow going, and I usually have to look at them once and say, okay, later, and then come back to them. And and realize that there's a translation to this time. For example, the we walking down the cloister, we might not call someone oh, Bodhisattva Mahasattva, great power obtained, glad to see you, you know. But it actually, that's a lot what we mean. It's similar, all the wondrous listener Bodhisattva or whatever. You know, all these terms that are old-fashioned, we would not use, but we use things that equally mean that, such as hall of golden light is what one of the Buddha's names mean, or meditation, or that sort of thing. But we don't really know what we're speaking unless we're feeling it. But anyway, this is it's called Bodhisattva Never Despise. And let's see. At one time he reappeared after many lives of training, when he was also entitled King of Majestic Voice Tathagata, worshipful, all-wise, perfectly enlightened in conduct, well-departed, understander of the world, peerless leader, controller, teacher of gods and men, Buddha, world-honored one. And then there were 20,000 Kodis of Buddhas who all had that same title. I'm sorry, I shouldn't laugh. I really won't. I'll stop that. After his extinction, came back again, and he spoke to an assembly. And he spoke of the Bodhisattva Bhikshu named Never Despise, great power obtained. For what reason was he named Never Despise? Because that Bhikshu paid respect to and commended everybody whom he saw. Bhikshu, Bhikshuni, Upasaka, Upasika, speaking thus, I deeply revere you. I dare not slight and contemn you. Wherefore? Because you all walk in the Bodhisattva way and are to become Buddhas. And that Bhikshu did not devote himself to reading and reciting sutras, but only to paying respect, so that when he saw afar off a member of the four groups, he would especially go and pay respect to them, commending them, saying, I dare not slight you because you are all to become Buddhas. Amongst the four groups, there were those who, irritated and angry and muddy-minded, reviled and abused him, saying, where did this ignorant bhikshu come from? Who takes it on himself to say, I do not slight you? And who predicts us as destined to become Buddhas? We need no such false prediction. I'm sorry, got to laugh at that. Anyway, thus he passed many years, constantly reviled but never irritated or angry, always saying, you are to become Buddhas. Whenever he spoke thus, the people beat him with clubs, sticks, potsherds, or stones. But while escaping to a distance, he still cried aloud, I dare not slight you. You are all to become Buddhas. And because he always spoke thus, the haughty bhikshus, bhikshunis, upasakas, upasikas styled him, Never Despise. When this bhikshu was drawing near his end, from the sky he heard and was entirely able to receive and retain 20,000 myriad kodis of verses of the Lotus Flower Sutra, which the Buddha of King of Majestic Voice had formerly preached. Whereupon he obtained, as above, clearness and purity of the eye organ and of the organs of ear, nose, tongue, body, and thought. Having obtained the purity of these organs, it goes on. There's more. I think it's enough of the story is there now to go on. And he, just to put it in context, he is, in this story, he is a Buddha talking to people who were at one time the throwers of the stones, but were now listeners to his Dharma talk. That's story number one. And then story number two is from Ajahn Chah. It's just a paragraph or so out of his discussion of marriage. And this will all come together in the talking about it later. And so, how can you make the mind clear? Just by knowing it. For example, you might think, today I'm in a really bad mood. Everything I look at offends me, even the plates in the cupboard. You might feel like smashing them up, every single one of them. Whatever you look at looks bad. The chickens, the ducks, the cats, and the dogs, you hate them all. Everything your husband says is offensive. Even looking into your own mind, you aren't satisfied. What can you do in such a situation? Where does this suffering come from? This is called having no merit. And near at the end of that long paragraph on merit, he says, constructing buildings is good, but it's not the best thing. Building your own mind into something good is the best way. This way you will find goodness whether you come here or stay at home. And I'll also have some more to say about that. Fourth story is called, it's a poem called, and I'll just do excerpts from it, called A Certain Weariness. I don't want to be tired alone. I want you to grow tired along with me. How can we not be weary? I'm tired of the harsh sea and the mysterious earth. I'm tired of chickens. Here come the chickens again. We never know what they think, and they look at us with dry eyes as though we were unimportant. Let us for once, I invite you, be tired of so many things, of awful apéritifs, of a good education, tired of not going to France, tired of at least one or two days in the week, which always have the same names, like dishes on the table, and of getting up, what for, and going to bed without glory. Then the last one. This is a longer one. It has, I excerpted it twice, so there may be a little bit of a repetition, but I don't think it'll be too tedious. So this is a story of a child who was blinded suddenly when he was 8 years old, and this is what happened to him when he suddenly realized he was blind, and as such a young child, he just naturally accepted, this is what I have to learn, to deal with. You know, this is my world. So here's what he wrote about it. Barely 10 days after the accident that blinded me, I made the basic discovery. I am still entranced by it. The only way I can describe that experience is in clear and direct words. I had completely lost the sight of my eyes. I could not see the light of the world anymore. Yet the light was still there. It was there. Try to imagine what a surprise that must have been for a boy not yet 8 years old. True, I could not see the light outside myself anymore. All the world around me was convinced that I had lost it forever. I felt it gushing forth and brimming over. I had only to receive it. It was unavoidably there. It was all there, and I found again its movement and shades, that is, its colors, which I had loved so passionately a few weeks before. I quickly learned that I knocked against things only when I forgot the light. Context is, his parents went ahead and kept him in a regular school, so he had to adapt to the seeing eye world. When I paid constant attention to the light, I ran a much smaller risk. The second great discovery came almost immediately afterward. That was the only one way to see the inner light, and that was to love. When I was overcome with sorrow, when I let anger take hold of me, when I envied those who saw, the light immediately decreased. Sometimes it even went out completely. I began to look more closely, not at things, but at a world closer to myself, looking from an inner place to one further within, instead of clinging to the movement of sight toward the world outside. Immediately the substance of the universe drew together, redefined and peopled itself anew. I was aware of a radiance emanating from a place I knew nothing about, a place which might as well have been outside me as within. But radiance was there, or to put it more precisely, light. It was a fact, for light was there. I felt indescribable relief and happiness so great it almost made me laugh. Confidence and gratitude came as if a prayer had been answered. I found light and joy at the same moment, and I can say without hesitation that from that time on, light and joy had never been separated in my experience. I have had them or lost them together. I saw light and went on seeing it, though I was blind. The amazing thing was that this was not magic for me at all, but reality. I could no more have denied it than people with eyes can deny that they see. I was not light myself, I knew that, but I bathed in it as an element which blindness had suddenly brought much closer. I could feel light rising, spreading, resting on objects, giving them form, then leaving them. Still, there were times when the light faded, almost to the point of disappearing. It happened every time I was afraid. If, instead of letting myself be carried along by confidence and throwing myself into things, I hesitated, calculated, thought about the wall, the half-open door, the key in the lock, if I said to myself that all these things were hostile and about to strike or scratch, then without exception I hit or wounded myself. The only easy way to move around the house, the garden, or the beach was by not thinking about it at all, or thinking as little as possible. Then I moved between obstacles the way they say bats do. What the loss of my eyes had not accomplished was brought about by fear. Fear made me blind. Anger and impatience had the same effect, throwing everything into confusion. The minute before, I knew just where everything in the room was, but if I got angry, things got angrier than I. I no longer knew where to put hand or foot. When I was playing with my small companions, if I suddenly grew anxious to win, to be first at all costs, then all at once I could see nothing. Literally, I went into fog or smoke. I could no longer afford to be jealous or unfriendly, because as soon as I was, a bandage came down over my eyes, and I was bound hand and foot and cast aside. But when I was happy and serene, approached people with confidence and thought well of them, I was rewarded with light. So that, I guess even if you have a blazing experience of light, you still have to watch what you're doing. So, one of the things that I saw in this story of him perceiving the light but then coming into difficulties was that he actually saw his own role in creating the difficulties. You know, it's like the Dhammapada, the mind is the forerunner of all states, mind is chief, mind made are they. So just as soon as he was hostile to the world, it seemed to him that the world was hostile to him. So it's looking in the, that's one of the meanings of looking in the mirror. And occasionally, this happened to an 8-year-old, so it's not like you have to be an advanced trainee to see it, but it just seems like it strikes you sometimes, oh, this is my doing. It's not someone else's fault. So then, let's see here. So then when it comes to the story of never despise, the three other stories specifically deal with greed, hate, and delusion. The never despise, there's a whole bed of delusion you could see in that story, which is that the listeners thought they, or the non-listeners, the rock throwers, thought they knew who could have the truth and who did and who didn't and who was despicable and who wasn't. But at the same time, it's an interesting story as a tool, because when I first heard that story, I thought, well, he is obnoxious. You know, like, who would want somebody coming up to you and saying, you know, oh, you're terrible, but you'll be better later? or you know, implying that, you know. So I understood it, and then later I understood that this is the dialogue of pride, you know, just of not being open-handed to the people and things at hand. If you have pride, you can't. It blocks, in a sense, it blocks the teaching that's being given. So your active use of the tool of training is to let go of preconceptions, let go of your views and opinions. As Reverend Master Kosen says, just for a second, just for a second. You can get them back later if you want them. But just let go, and the suffering that's involved in the pride also passes. Then when it comes to the story of, the next one was the I hate this, I hate that story. I would say that's dealing with hate. And the tool in the Buddhist treasury is to sit still with it and generate loving kindness. You know, and there, it may be kind of a big leap to generate loving kindness, but you're also, it might be worth it to you at some point when you're tired of suffering, going by suffering via grouchiness, excessive grouchiness. And then you'll be possibly willing to make use of that tool. So, then there is the certain wearing, at the end of that, he says, this is an example of not having merit. And there's a clue there. And that is that as soon as you realize you're not having merit, you can begin making merit. Just by turning to, for example, gratitude. Gratitude is one of the Buddhist practices that generates merit. And as you find gratitude, you spread it, and it becomes a form of love as well. If you can't find gratitude, one way I go, if I can't find gratitude, is to remember, for example, sometime when I'm sick. And this is actually another Buddhist gift. Illness is a Buddhist gift because it has much to teach you. But in any case, one of the things it can teach you, even if it was just the flu, is what for me is to remember what it feels like the morning after you're not sick anymore. And suddenly you can walk and you can eat a piece of toast, you know, and feel the sun and you know, you're free of your sickness. And that right there is a natural gratitude, but you can find it in anything. You know, it doesn't always need to be contrasted with something awful happening. It's just that there is nothing which is not being a gift to you in your day. So that would be the beginning of letting go of grouchiness. So that being... if we go on to the certain weariness, that's more like, I would say, greed. Greed that is being denied to the person who is greedy, because all their days are spread out before them, like, as some people say, a heavenly garden in a sense. But they're just bored, and they, or we do it to ourselves. It's actually a direct active answer to it is also gratitude, but one of the skills in the treasure chest is bowing, and you can anytime you are bored. It's true if you're having hate as well, you can bow and see what happens. And I know in this culture, bowing is an unusual activity, but when you do it, you start to understand why you would do it. You can, as you bow, you can let go of everything. And as Ajahn Chah says, you know, the self is like a bucket of water. It's not heavy if you don't pick it up. If you let it go, you can. That's one. Whether we are wearing a kesa or not, just bowing puts the kesa upon our bodies. So with all of this, and with actually with the whole, our whole life, I see that it is attention which makes the difference. Paying attention, and the quality of your attention is something that you can train using the tools of Buddhism. Meditation is one of them. And you soon find out how much attention you don't pay when you try to pay attention in meditation or in single-pointed activities in daily life. In fact, as I was making a fire the other day, wadding up the newspaper, the headline was, "The New Superpower, Mindfulness, Doing One Thing at a Time." And it's really true. It's really hard to do just one thing at a time. There's so many things in your mind that I could be getting more done or something. You know, somehow it seems to cause a bit of nervousness. But with the help of teachers and other people training with us, a lot of that is eased. You know, I remember working side by side with a teacher who's no longer living, but I was, at the time, I was just so excited to be standing next to a teacher, somebody I really respected, and so I was jabbering away, and he just turned to me and said, "Slow down." And oh, that's all I have to do. And another teacher, I was likewise not doing one-pointed activity. I was kind of tossing the laundry on the drying rack, you know, like any which way, it'll get dry, you know. And the teacher comes up, picks up the laundry, puts it on. She says, "I just love to do laundry." And ever since then, whenever I hang up clothes, I feel like, yes, I do love to do laundry. You know, it's very, there's only one thing. And another lovely, simple project is to water the garden. You know, I took the job, someone had the job of watering the garden and they were gone, so I had to do it. And all I could do was stand there. And I know the gardeners among us know this feeling, but I was stand there with my watering bucket and let the flowers be watered, and I was doing everything in the world I was supposed to be doing, and that's all I had to pay attention to. It felt very freeing and uplifting. So there are a whole bunch more packets of the different skills and instruments that we have, including the four brahmacharya, divine abodes. I wanted to speak to them in part because when we're talking about the things that are available in Buddhism, we often count them in numbers. But in fact, sometimes there's a reason for a number like that. Any one of those, the four divine abodes, let me see, as I remember them, they are equanimity, loving kindness, compassion, and sympathetic joy. And actually, each one of those needs the others in order for it to be a true abode. So they really do work together. If you're just compassionate, you may not have equanimity, for one. It'd be really easy to not have equanimity if you're only compassionate, I would think. So anyway, that's one of them. Then there's the paramitas. Oh yeah, in fact, there's a list of antidotes for the various kind of negativities that we get into, most of which were included in these stories. And for example, the antidote for pride is open-handed response to the situation, and that's not having preconceptions. And it's, I suppose I should consider cutting my talk short rather than going on at length with all those things. But it is in fact a common thing to think you're looking clearly and to actually have part of your openness closed. And an example is in modern day science, the scientist takes an organ to look at it under microscope, freeze dries it, slices it up, and looks at it under microscope, and deduces without even realizing it that what was once fluid and alive, which is called the interstitium, I guess, it's a lining of all our organs, within and without our organs, that's filled with liquid that travels through our bodies. No one knew it in the West until maybe a year or so they started to discover, oh, when we look at it not under the microscope, it's absolutely different than we look at it under the microscope. And it makes a whole difference in how you assess the physical. And they were doing their best, and they had the best tools available to them, but they were still partly blinded by a lack of, eventually you find out what you're missing, but they were missing something, let's just put it that way. Jealousy is another karmic sickness that you can transform by doing something for someone, not the person you're jealous of, but someone or something else, doing something. Anger, we talked about. Stinginess, obviously, is giving. Giving in not just a sort of disrespectful way, like not giving, as one teacher said, not giving the smallest apple in your basket or the one that has a mark and you didn't want to eat anyway or something. Anyway, making merit benefits. This is a form of making merit, and it benefits the cleansing of karma, as does generosity of spirit and stillness. Cleansing karma is the healing of body and mind for the benefit of others. Be still and allow analysis and confusion to arise and pass. Then see in the stillness some aspect of what's going on you tend to discover. And the last thing I want to talk about is silence, which is an essential nutrient. And I used to hear someone say, oh, I'm studying silence. And I would kind of like, what? I could almost not believe they were serious. But it turns out to be true that silence has a lot to offer. And if you can make a guarded, silent time in your life, it's very helpful. Let's just quickly look here. There's koans. Is another one of the skills, but I won't go into that today. So we're training the quality of attention. Everything can teach. If you look with a heart, mind, spirit open, you will see the truth being shown to you at all times. And then if you can realize that there are all sorts of things that you don't need to have a view about, then you are beginning to see. That's Reverend Master Khotan. Then there is... I'm sorry, this is a bit of a scramble of some of the other tools that I wanted to talk about, but I'm getting to the end. And one of the tools is discomfort. And in fact, at one point, Reverend Master Khotan said, fear is compassion. And no one knew what he meant, it seemed. And we asked him about it, and he said, well, anything that disturbs you into looking closer is a force of compassion. And then there's a quote that I found on a matchbox when I first came here, and I've had that matchbox ever since, that says, it's a quote from Khalil Gibran, and I don't know if the person who put it on the matchbox is still here, but I have a few guesses. But the quote is, comfort murders engagement, or actually the actual quote is, comfort murders passion, but I want it to be understood in a Buddhist sense. Comfort murders engagement and then walks grinning at the funeral. So comfort is not always your friend. You do need to rest, but it's not always your friend. So back to the silence. Silence is an essential nutrient, a practice based on respect. You know, no one is quiet is unless they have some respect for the person they're listening to. And the depth of silence supports the depth of hearing. And so you, as you sit and meditate, your silence becomes deeper over time. And when the ears are turned inward, one hears the voice of the Eternal. Listen from the heart. Let go of all the things that are passing through. Listening is the universal gateway, and Kanzan is the universal gateway bodhisattva, who hears and regards the cries of the world. I always resisted the thought that Kanzan is a being. You know, I would always, it's the embodiment of compassion or whatever. And yet, it feels, has the feeling of a being, because it's one with compassion, and listening is likewise, hearing and bowing. So to put that into practice in the most basic way that helps you immediately is to just listen. Take the regular ears and just listen to whatever you do hear. And don't put the self in the way of what you're receiving. And it can be an opening to the truth. And there will be times when there's actually a physical silence when you do that listening. And my last retreat, this happened where I woke in the middle of the night and there was no sound, no people anywhere near, no boundaries, a wide open silence. And I couldn't believe how good it felt. And just, wow, a party, you know. So I sat there in silence. I lit a candle, and there was the crackling of a fire in the stove and the candlelight on the Buddha's face, and then the glow in the forest as the sun came up. And I just think all of these fine friends and this world that we are in together. Thank you.